live from the Findlay Toyota Studios, it's Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
Disturbing Raiders and Cowboys. I'll tell you where I was watching the game and the mood there. And Adam obviously was at the stadium. But we got to start out with an upbeat note here in the Findlay Toyota Studios. The Pop-Tart Bowl, which I know you're all over.
Sure.
How you don't get that assignment, actually, to go to the game every year is beyond me. They have gone next level now. Did you see this? Because I will tell you, there's one person in the media, and we, lovely lady, we got to talk to her at the Big Ten Media Days. Nicole Auerbach loves... I don't know if she loves Pop-Tarts, but she loves the Pop-Tart Bowl because I notice every year she goes hog wild on social media when they have their release.
Yeah, I think, by the way, I think Michigan will love.
Oh, is that right?
Pretty sure. Not 100% positive on that, I thought so.
Shouldn't have had her on.
But that's good.
Banned. You're banned.
So they're introducing six edible mascots?
Six now. Not just the one that they throw in a fake toaster.
But then the fans are going to be able to vote on which one actually gets sacrificed?
Is it a team that gets sacrificed or just one of the six? This is what I was unclear on.
I guess three of them.
Wow.
So three on three.
Team Sprinkle and Team... We got to look it up.
Swirls. Yeah.
I don't know the difference. I haven't really been... Not to give these breakfast toasters much more name recognition, but I haven't... And I used to be a big Pop-Tart guy because I used to be a big convenience store guy. So anything that was sugary and gross that I could combine with a 44-ounce Mountain Dew. I told you in the old days, it used to be those pudding pies.
Yeah.
I would drive around covering high school sports, 44-ounce Mountain Dew. And basically, this was the weather all fall in New Jersey. This is why I am the way I am, right? This just sets you for life. And I'm pointing outside the Vegas weather with the rain and the dank and overcast. And then I would combo it with... the 44-ounce Mountain Dew with a pudding pie or a Pop-Tart. And more recently, the toaster little things have
strudel?
Become
have
become very popular.
On those pies, which I don't even know if they
make. They might be like, do you even get, what's a two-pack now?
Of Pop-Tarts?
Yeah. At a convenience store. Is it over $2? I try not to look at prices at convenience stores because it is shocking. The other day, I'm like, let me get a cheap snack. I'm like, wait, a thing of peanuts, a sleeve of peanuts? It used to be like two for a dollar. I got to pay $2 now?
Must not have gone in a while. Prices are way down, Steve. Affordability.
We're being told that, yes. But I noticed on my several of these random trips, it's gone up.
Yeah, I think the Pop-Tarts definitely have gone up. Now, I was wondering on your fruit, on your pie, though, were you going like the chocolate ones? The fruit ones are at least somewhat healthy, I guess, because they're fruit flavored.
No, it was...
I don't think they even make... I think those are... Like, we have a lot of really unhealthy things in society.
In our society, yeah.
I think those were deemed so unhealthy that they just stopped making them. I don't see them anymore.
The pudding pie?
Well, there's the pudding one, and then there's like a fruit one.
Which one's gone?
There's different flavors. I don't think they make those anymore at all.
I used to do the fruit.
You're talking about like the... I would do like an apple. It's like a pie.
Yeah, I think it was like Hostess. It was just gooiness. Either pudding or the apple.
Yeah, I don't see them. I
or blueberry.
I don't see them at the store, so I don't know that they make
with
those
with a 44-ounce Mountain Dew.
Well, at least blueberry.
I keep giving that drink a free pop, but...
At least that's fruit.
What a combination.
Energy, man. Not the healthiest thing, obviously, on the planet.
Energy.
The flavors of the Pop-Tarts are the most important thing because they're ones that people like. And I'll say there's a...
Do you eat them dry?
Yeah.
I eat them dry.
Yeah.
I love them dry. Actually, I don't think I've ever toasted one.
No, why would you? I think usually you'd buy them like at the convenience store on the run where you don't have a toaster necessarily to... there is a place I won't say where it is. There's a place I'm frequently at almost every day. And there is like a different snack selection every day put out for the people that are there. And it usually includes... a Pop-Tart or two, like in the pack. And I would say the flavors are not usually are not very high on my list.
We do have to get one thing out of the way before this big announcement. We really make it official here. The game is in Orlando. Haven't we argued about what the actual name is?
No, that's the Cheez-It Bowl.
Okay. It is Pop-Tarts.
Yeah.
December 27th. Boy, what a wonderful spot that would be for maybe UNLV to fill in if a conference couldn't. Ooh. Fill in the spots.
And that's the dream. Nobody wants to go to Boise or New Mexico.
The RJ will, for once, quadruple staff a UNLV game. It'll be all over that one.
Everybody's got one.
All hands on deck. 3:30 start in Orlando. Orlando's nice. in December?
Here's the problem. It's not. It's fine, but that's downtown. Downtown Orlando is not. That's where the game is, right? Because I think the stadium is downtown.
I didn't know that. I've never been to that stadium.
If I remember correctly, it's downtown and south of Orlando, where the resorts are. Fine, it's very touristy. It's fine. Downtown's not the greatest.
I think I've been to downtown. Mascots will be vying to be part of the biggest sacrifice ever. Drop the flavors you think will be competing in the comments. They have six different flavors, and yes, it is a team that you vote on. Three of the tarts will be sacrificed. They will be toasted to death. that's a great end to a bowl game.
Sure. I don't know if they're going to try to pair
them up. A lot of college
up.
Football fans would like to kill their coach at the end of a bowl game, but in this case, you don't have to do it. Have this gooiness.
I wonder if they're going to be related flavors or if they're going to be completely different. Like, do you go, like, does Team Hot Fudge Sunday Pop-Tart also have, like, Team Chocolate and Team Fudge?
I don't know the flavors that well. That's why you're here.
Or is the other team is like, the blueberry, the strawberry, and, like, maybe the brown cinnamon, or they try to make them related?
I don't know. We'll follow this with bated breath the next 5 weeks.
Maybe a s'mores and hot fudge sundae are like the captains, like so that you separate them instead of putting them on the same team.
I couldn't even tell you what the best flavors are. I mean, I think it's the cinnamon sugar and then the strawberry.
The brown cinnamon sugar is the worst one.
I think it's the best one.
That's the one that I was referring to. It's always out at the free place, and I'm like, no.
I love it. It's real chalky when you eat it dry, too.
S'mores is obviously it's the best one.
Too sweet for me.
No, it's fantastic. Did you see, since I'm a big mascot person, did you know? I'm sure that's why you put this right at the top today with me coming back. Did you see the mascot football game against the kids where they ran the tush push?
I saw a highlight, but I kind of refused to document it. Although I should have.
Why?
I should have. Well, because you were in. I don't know why I refused to document it, but. It just looked weird.
I'm
kind of tired of talking about the tush push. Maybe they spiced it up a little bit.
I mean, it's just funny that a bunch of mascots just lined up together and just formed a massive humanity or mascot entity, I guess you would say, and just lined up against the kids and just ran them over. I mean, I like all the Colts do, I think, an annual football game mascots against the kids and, you know, juke them and run them over and mess with them a little bit, which is great. But just going tush push and knocking all these kids down was pretty fantastic. It was a good highlight. I was impressed by the play call for sure. I'm not sure who the coordinator was. I'm certain it wasn't Chip Kelly.
Well, yeah, we're gonna hold off on Chip. Okay.
I know. But
we're doing anything we can at the start of the show.
Sure.
I'm actually gonna go south of here to Phoenix because I got to talk about Arizona State. And I saw a headline today, and I was like, yeah, sounds about right. And people are melting down. Why?
Yeah.
Report. Arizona State star quarterback Sam Leavitt, his return to the program in 2026 is doubtful, according to Pete Nakos. Leavitt's camp is actively shopping the talented passer, quote, at a high level. I don't know if this was in response to hearing that news. I don't think it was. It's unrelated. But, you know, the coaches who are a little bit younger or those who don't have as much equity or don't have the support they want have been more aggressive than ever talking about NIL. And I thought this was interesting. I don't know if I like it, but here's Kenny D, the head coach at Arizona State, talking about wanting restaurant support. I don't know if he's making complete sense here.
Like, I don't get it. $500 a month, $1,000 a month, right? It's a business expense because it's a marketing expense, right? If you're a local company and you want to engage community, or if you're a new business and you want to get people involved, what better way to get your brand out there, the city, than utilizing our players? So everybody thinks this is like a race to, you know, I can't give a $700,000 deal. No, we have a city behind us. If every restaurant in our city gave a kid a $500 or $1,000 a month deal to advertise them for them, I don't know the math behind the amount of restaurants, but I feel like we'd be in a good spot. And I know we're not going to get all of them, but what if we got 25% of them?
Has Kenny Dillingham ever sold advertising or anything else? 25% success rate on restaurants in the whole area or just in Tempe?
Wow, that'd be pretty high.
Does he also know what's going on at restaurants? Like,
yeah.
They're going under left and right. A lot of places don't have $500 or $1,000 for multiple players each month. Kenny, relax. Kenny Dillingham, the head coach at Arizona State. Here's part two of his comments.
I do want to say, like, the university has, they've been very, very supportive. Now it's The fan base has been unbelievably supportive. Now it's okay, this last step. How can we work it together to where the local businesses, successful people in the Valley, want to see us succeed? Because our success leads to more success in local business. That's all it is. I mean, we're a revenue generator for the city. If you're a local business guy and you have nothing to do with Arizona State, well, our success can help your business, and our success helps the city that you live in.
It is a nice pitch. In theory, he's right. But not every restaurant wants to spend its marketing money the same way. And not everyone cares about Arizona State in a city like Phoenix.
And also, yeah, there's also major league teams they could endorse and be a part of. And that is the competition as well. Now, I guess, you know, to his pitch, you're not going to get in with the Suns for $500 a month or $1,000 a month. You could get in
with the players directly. No, it's not going to happen.
So, I mean, I think that's the way you go, the more affordable option if you want to have endorsements and, you know, you don't think you can afford to get one of the, you know, you can't get Michael Wilson after his, 185 yards or whatever for the Cardinals. You can get somebody from Arizona State. Like, that's more affordable. Maybe that's the pitch that you go with. But I can definitely picture people being uncomfortable with this anyway. Just, why is this a coach's job to go out there and
it is.
Try to do this? But it is.
It is.
That's the reality.
So I don't fault him for trying. I just don't think I think you got to be careful in your local market. Not that restaurants are going to get all insulted. Like, I'm not supporting him. Well, you weren't supporting him
right already.
Giveaway time. Two VIP passes for the Crossroads Gun Show. Crossroadsgunshow.com is where you can get the ticket and all the tickets and all the info. But we've got two VIP passes. The event goes down this weekend at the Speedway. 364-1100, caller 7. Caller 7, caller 7. It's actually two different two VIP passes. So we'll do caller 7 and caller 8. Check out the event at Crossroads Gun Shows.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
So we're going to kind of reverse engineer that game last night. We'll get to a lot of the Raiders game against the Cowboys as the show moves along, especially in the 5 o'clock hour and at 4:45 with Jesse Merrick, who's out there with Adam Hill, who is the company today. Jesse, of course, from Silver and Black Sports Network. But one of the things I wanted to talk about, because I was watching the game, but couldn't completely be engaged. But I finally got some time to really concentrate, and it was late in the game. What I saw after a safety was one of the greatest feats in the history of the NFL, until it wasn't.
Yeah.
And I thought of you because you're a special teams guru. I don't know. I don't know if you have a bed at A.J. Cole's house, but you may as well. You love the man.
It's the entire special teams group.
It's amazing. Okay. So tell us what happened. We'll get into the safety later on. But there's a safety. The Raiders come out, and A.J. Cole's on the field, and you hear the whoever it is, Buck and Aikman, are like, okay, they just alerted that they're going to be going for the onside kick here. I think they're, 3-38 on the year. I'm like, okay, this is going to be boring as hell. And then, wait, A.J. Cole's out there. What's going on here? Is he just going to take the ball sideways and kick it like a rocket and just try to slam it off someone 11 yards away?
No, he's not. You can, on a free kick, that's after a safety, not after any – it's not a regular kickoff. So after a field goal or a touchdown, you can't do it. But after a safety, you can elect to punt, and it's a live ball. Now, still has the same parameters, has to go 10 yards and can't go past the 45, I believe. So it has to be in a certain area. But you can punt. And by the way, as an offense, you can catch it in the air. It's a really, really smart play. Now, that can be negated by a fair catch signal. So if the other team just signals fair catch, you can't go catch it. You have to let them catch it.
Oh, wow.
But how many teams are prepared and know that? So there's a lot that goes into this. Bottom line, basically, I saw a lot of people just mocking, Raiders can't even get this right. Like, they got it right.
It was the greatest thing I've ever seen.
It was a fantastic play.
A.J. Cole brilliant punted kick. I thought he punted it backwards. At first, because I was like, wow, he kicked that straight up in the air. I think it's going backwards. Then he punted it 13 yards with height.
I was told.
Whatever it was, 18 yards, yeah. Whatever it was.
I was told by somebody within the organization that there might have been mockery last night, but within 5 years, there will be teach tapes on that kick. Hmm. It was perfect.
It was unbelievable.
In every way. Now, the issue is nobody went and got it.
Did they not school the guys on what to do? Because, like, what would you... Listen, I'm very rudimentary. I'll have to run this by, you know, I don't know, Adam Shire over at UNLV. If you're going to kick the ball between... Because you got to get to 10 yards. If you're going to kick between 13 and 18, isn't there a target for, like, half the guys on that side of the field on your team to just run to a line, turn, locate the ball? Because everyone just tiptoed, and they're, like, looking up. And then who was the guy who... It landed next to him, and he was like, Carter Runyon?
Definitely appeared to be some confusion on what they should be doing in terms of getting the ball.
Yep.
But so here's the real question. So if you go back and watch it again, there's a question as to whether George Pickens signaled for a fair catch. If he did,
he could have duped him.
If he did, then you have to let him catch it.
Okay.
And it looked like maybe the Raiders thought he did. Now, I will say, watching it, George Pickens was as confused as anyone. Mm-hmm. He went to raise his hand, and then he dropped it. And then you could tell he's like, am I supposed, like,
what do I do?
Because part of the play is that everybody's going to be confused.
Right.
And they were. And it worked. Now, if George Pickens signaled fair catch, they can't go get it. They have to wait until it hits the ground. But then when it hits the ground, go get it. And they didn't. But I think maybe they thought he signaled fair catch. And maybe he did. But it's just really unclear because he wasn't sure what he should do.
So the Raiders execute the first half of one of the greatest special teams plays in the history of the National Football League and somehow completely botch it in the second half.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
I got something to say. If you don't like that I'm having a good time, I'm having fun today doing the show. If you don't like that I'm having a good time while dealing with a tough time, then just go ahead. I ruined it. And unfollow and casually move on. That was actually Cam Scadaboo, who got a rash of crap for being at a wrestling event, Monday Night Raw, WWE, in New York. Now, remember, he dislocated his ankle a couple of weeks ago. I thought of that almost immediately as wrestlers came over to him. What do you think?
I mean, I understand why people would be worked up about it. Like, hey, you can't play, but you can do this. And what if he further got hurt?
I mean, is there anyone out? He didn't get in the ring.
He was in a shoving match.
Okay.
I was like, what if you further got hurt? What if something happened where it further set you back? Like,
I think that would be the question. I wanted to see a shot with his legs. Sure. I would assume he has, like, a pretty thick cast and a walking boot.
Sure. Yeah, I think the risk was incredibly minimal. But what I'm saying is I'm sure there's people watching that immediately were just like, what if he fell down? What if this went wrong? What if something would have happened here and it would have set him back? Like, I get that part of it. But also when he tweets that, like, yes, you're right. Like, he's dealing with injury. It probably sucks. He's probably depressed. Hey, this is a way to be, like, active, competitive, whatever. Again, I mean, not competitive, I guess. But
I think it would have been cool if they double casted him and he actually – like, got kneed, and they broke the top cast to scare the crap out of
people. Somebody threw him in, like, a figure four.
Like, really worked the leg. Figure four?
Yeah. Something.
He's flipping out.
Leg lock of some sort.
They take him out on a stretcher, and then afterwards he's like, I'm okay.
That would have been fun.
Yeah, Giants fans are a little high-strung. They're going through a 2-9 season. So much so that did they have an unexcused absence the other day at practice, and now we've got Sleepgate?
Maybe.
With Abdul Carter?
We still don't know what happened with CeeDee Lamb and George Pickens necessarily for their suspension to start the game yesterday. But there was another one because Abdul Carter was supposed to make the start, did not, set out the first six plays of the – that was the first possession of the game. And there was a report out that he had slept through a practice. He's not happy with that. He's saying, okay, look, not what happened. There was miscommunication. Essentially what he said was he was getting treatment. Which, and I can tell you from being in the building every day, there's a place guys go for treatment. You see him, there's somebody not in the locker room. People are like, oh, where is he? Even players, oh, he's not here. Oh, he's getting treatment right now. Like, it's a very separate thing.
So that could be
lost
in the shuffle.
It's a very separate thing.
But someone clearly did leak from the inside the Giants that he overslept.
Sure.
You don't just make that up.
Sure. What he said was he was in treatment. Obviously, there was a major change last week with the Giants. They changed coaching staffs.
Yeah.
And that they changed the practice time. Like, Mike Kafka changed the practice time where he had his routine. I know every day this is what the practice is. I was getting treatment. They took the practice field. That's what happened. I would imagine. I'm speaking from Raiders, knowing the Raiders situation, and I'm in there. Like, everywhere you go, there are video boards that have the schedule for the day.
Ah.
So, like, if I walk into, say, where the lunchroom is, if I walk into where the practice field is, if I walk into the locker room, if I walk into the equipment room, whatever, there's a video board up there with, like, the practice schedule for the day.
Right.
And we use it for, hey, I'm going to be in the locker room this time to talk to players, but I see there's a special teams meeting at this time. Probably not going to be able to talk to special teams guys today. Oh, there's a meeting at this time.
So you don't believe this. You think he overslept.
Well, maybe.
Or the Giants are just a crappy organization and unorganized.
Maybe the Giants don't have video boards that say what time to go to things. Who knows? I don't know exactly what happened. I will say the fact that he was very forceful and spoke out about it probably tells me there might be some truth to it, because people can come back. Whoever the source was that said he slept.
Yeah.
Can then come back to the same media person and say, no.
Or, like, let's get proof that he was actually getting treatment. We got a football game coming up here in town on Friday, the Ninth Island Showdown for the Golden Pineapple. You can go. UNLV football taking on Hawaii. 7:30 start. We've got two tickets right now, 364-1100, 364-1100. It's caller 7 for UNLV in Hawaii this Friday night at Allegiant Stadium. You can grab your tickets at unlvtickets.com, but right now, caller 7, you get two from Ruben, 364-1100.
Now back to Cofield and Company on ESPN Las Vegas.
It's a Tuesday. We check in on the world of MMA and also Raiders. We'll get to the Raiders. RJ Clifford is with us from the Autumn Windbags. Man, it was rough on Monday night. But interesting UFC card. I think we touted it last week as one of the best cards of the year. We'll determine if it was the main event. Interesting fight. I did see people complaining about it. Again, you know, a fighter controlling the other fighter. So give me the grade on what Makhachev did in this fight.
Well, as far as being dominant, winning, and becoming a double champion, it was an A+. It was one-way traffic the entire time. 50-45, Jack Della Maddalena was on a massive win streak and a real fantastic fighter, and a guy that showed, and when he won the title against Bilal Muhammad, that he had a great style of fighting against a grappler, kind of Dagestani wrestler striker. That's not Bilal Muhammad, but he kind of incorporates that style, and he's like a kind of a cousin to that team. Jack Della Maddalena, he's a true welterweight. Islam Makhachev has fought most of his career at lightweight. I mean, this is going to be really intriguing. JDM can probably keep it on the feet and beat him up. Nope, not even kinda. It was Islam winning the striking. It was Islam winning the grappling. Once he got on top, JDM never really got up. And there was a lot of talk about how, as good as Islam Makhachev is, he's not a small lightweight by any means, but every single one of his title fights were against guys that were featherweights at one point, guys that were 10 pounds lighter, Dustin Poirier, and every single guy he's fought. It's like, oh, the side, he won't be able to bully JDM the way he's able to do all these other lightweights. And he bullied him easier than anybody he's had so far in his championship run. So Islam's getting better, which is even scarier.
Well, they put together a wonderful card in that they had other 170 fighters on there, and it was a hell of a showcase. I'm going to start with Prates, and that was impressive. That was basically, it was like a hybrid jab and straight left. I mean, you rarely see a guy go down right down the freaking pipe and actually get lifted off the ground.
Well, especially Leon Edwards, a former champion and one of the smoothest, cleanest defensive fighters out there. Leon Edwards had never been knocked out before. That was his 29th mixed martial arts professional fight. Never been KO'd because he's so defensively sound. He's so savvy. And sometimes that turns into kind of a boring-ish fight every now and then. That's why the style matchup was so great. Carlos Prates is super aggressive Muay Thai striker, a little reckless, kind of rounds his punches, not really like straightening out his punches as much. So how would that play against a Leon Edwards, who's super savvy, can fight really well going backwards, great in the clinch, no drastically terrible area. And as it turns out, Prates just took one punch, and it wasn't even at the end of a combination. It wasn't even something that was even all set up all that great. It was just Prates from that stance just right down the middle, and Leon Edwards got KO'd for the first time in his career, and bad.
You got to school me on Prates in his career. How does that guy have 7 losses?
So he started out kind of like not great. Like a lot of these Brazilian fighters, like they'll come into the UFC with these super inflated records. Like they'll just fight ham and eggers and cab drivers for the first like 6 years of their career. If they had like really manicured careers, Carlos Prates didn't. He didn't go to the Fighting Nerds until later. So he was 5-4 at one point in his career. And he came into the UFC. He was 10-6 at one point in his career as well. And he reeled off a ton of wins. Finally lost to Ian Machado Gary last year. But that's his only loss since like before we knew what COVID was. And so, yeah, you look at that guy and you're like, how does he ever lose? Like I said, he can be a little reckless. And I think Ian Machado Gary kind of proved that there are some defensive holes in his game. But yeah, like once he gets going downhill, like bite down your mouthpiece because the heat's coming.
Well, he's won 13 or 14 going back to 2019. Did you buy what Rogan was saying, that his trash talk actually threw his opponent out of whack a little bit, that he decided to stand? Because he really didn't go for the clinch or a takedown in the second round.
That is a really true phenomenon. Rogan likes to get, like, he has half a dozen narratives that he just kind of loves to go back to. He's not cutting weight anymore. That means he's going to have all this energy. It's like, yeah, he's also fighting somebody 15 pounds heavier, which drains you. That's part of it, right? Like he has his narratives, right? And some, but that is a true thing. Now, whether a really savvy fighter like Leon Edwards was like Jedi mind tricked into doing a bad game plan, I don't know if I buy. I think it's more just coming into Carlos Prates comes with some serious consequences. He's a great reactionary uppercut, good reactionary knee. And Leon Edwards isn't like, he's an English guy. He's not some like all-American wrestler from Iowa is going to throw on a singlet and just shoot 13 double legs on you. So it's just, yeah, I don't know. I'm not willing to buy that.
It seemed like it. Cause he kind of called it that, hey, he's talking trash and Leon standing in front of him. Tell RJ Clifford's with us from ESPN, or not from ESPN Las Vegas, on ESPN Las Vegas, RJ Clifford MMA, and of course from the Autumn Windbags. What are the Fighting Nerds? Where are they fighting out of?
They're from Brazil. So they had kind of run into a little bit of a rough patch. Carlos Prates was, I believe, the first Fighting Nerd to lose. So there's about half a dozen of them in the UFC, and they were on like a 17-0 streak at one point, all knocking on the door of title shots. It didn't go great to close out, or it's like kind of the early middle part of this year. That most of them kind of picked up a loss. Jean Silva got a loss. I mentioned Carlos Prates losing earlier this year, but they're kind of back on a winning track. Carlos Prates now back-to-back knockouts after losing to Ian Machado Gary, and he's now kind of back in the title picture a little bit in a really, really stacked welterweight division. But they have this kind of novelty, right? Like they love their marketing gimmick. They have the little glasses with the tape over it. It's like, oh, we're the Fighting Nerds. And you think like, okay, that's kind of a stupid gimmick. But if you keep winning, kind of everything's cool. Like you can make anything cool if you're winning. Like if I dressed up like Jelly Roll, you'd be like, you look like a moron. But if I was a platinum selling artist, you'd be like, oh yeah, it works for you. Like that's
little Jelly
Roll. Fighting Nerds.
Little jelly. RJ Clifford's up on ESPN Las Vegas. So with Prates winning, it seems like there's an obvious path to the title. But there was another guy on the card in Michael Morales who, I got to tell you, to me, that stance is ridiculous. He's like bent over. His face is right in front of you. Then his punches are like way out in front. It doesn't look like a technically sound guy. But, man, he just the pressure he puts on and the punches coming from all angles, that was destruction.
19-0, 14 knockouts. He's 26 years old.
Wow.
Like just a specimen. Like he's built like an NFL free safety, but he fights at 170 pounds. And so like, and also he was going against Sean Brady, who is as close. There's no such thing in 2025 anymore as just like a pure grappler. Like everyone's a little, you know, got some well-rounded attributes to it, but this was as close of a striker versus grappler matchup as you can get. With Sean Brady. And so that stance works. If you're not worried about getting knocked out, you can lean forward, your chin can be out. That's their first layer of defense from a takedown, like your head and your hand, and then your hips is the last level. So it was a fine stance for Sean Brady, and he's just a specimen, man. Like that was his first really, really big test against Sean Brady. Like you think of a guy with that kind of record, he'd be just killing everybody. But that was his first like top 10 guy in his prime. Like he knocked out Neil Magny, knocked out Gilbert Burns, but Brady was, this was really dangerous for Brady, and props to him for taking this fight. Like if he would have just waited, there's a really good chance he'd be next for a title shot. if Sean Brady just kind of like sat and waited and let things get worked out with Islam Makhachev and JDM, there's a really good chance he would have been next. But he said, like, look, no, I'm going to fight. So props to him, but kind of bit him in the butt.
I love that, though, but he should get a title fight down the road. And here's how I would matchmake, and I'm sure if I was talking to Dana White face-to-face, he'd be like, shut the hell up. But this is what I would do. Makhachev can be a dominant guy at 170. I think he can be a really sellable guy. I hate the fact that, again, we've got, you know, another kind of, you know, Russian former Soviet guy who maybe he's not going to be able to promote the fights. But whatever, you make good fights at 170. And now the division has all these younger guys instead of old grapplers.
Yep.
I would go with Prates first. Someone should be fired if Prates and Morales are fighting each other. That's stupid. You keep them separate. You go Prates first, then Morales. And if Brady, keep him clean, I think he gets the third shot. And then we see what the division looks like. But you have two strikers. Make them both go against Makhachev. Don't have them fight each other.
Well, you've got Ian Garry, who has a win over Carlos Prates, which
good
kind
point.
Of
so that's another guy
misses some things up. But here's and then you have Shavkat Rakhmonov, who's undefeated and beat Ian Garry, but he's been injured and sitting. Like, welterweight is insane. That's why when we talked about this on the show, I hated Islam Makhachev going up to 175 JDM. 170, it's been an awesome weight class for as long as MMA's been around. It's been a top three weight class. George St. Pierre, Matt Hughes, Tyron Woodley, Kamaru Usman, like, it's been loaded forever. It may be better now than it's ever been. And so, of course, you're going to have a lightweight go up and keep the title busy for another little bit. I actually have this, and I just thought of it today, Cofield. This is what I want to do. Ilya Topuria called out Islam Makhachev, who was the former lightweight champion and now, or excuse me, featherweight champion. Now he's a lightweight champion. That's the super fight that people are talking about. I think you do Ilya Topuria versus Islam Makhachev, catchweight at the White House. Super fight, catchweight fight. They both relinquish their titles. You do Morales versus Shavkat for the vacant welterweight title in April. You do Justin Gaethje, Armin Sarukian, if Armin beats Hooker this Saturday, for the vacant lightweight title in May. And then Ilya and Islam go back to their original weight classes and challenge for the winners of those two fights. I think that's the best way to kind of keep everything going and still give the White House this, because you cannot make a better, there's bigger fights, Conor returning, John Jones, but you can't make a better mixed martial arts contest today than Ilya Topuria versus Islam Makhachev. It's just chef's kiss, too perfect. So I think you bend the rules a little bit and you get as many title fights as you can and top-notch guys involved.
Is there any way they'll do that?
Well, now it's a different world, because the reason fighters didn't want to be stripped before was because of pay-per-view points. Because you only get pay-per-view points if you're a champion defending your belt. Now, there's pay-per-view gone now. So I think fighters would be more willing. Because if you get paid the same, whether you're defending a title or fighting for a title, I don't know if you care. So I think if the UFC makes it worth Ilya and Islam's while, and I know the giant White House card, I think that's the potential is there. You know the other four fighters are down for a vacant title fight and then defending against the champions. Otherwise, you do all these fights anyway, but not for titles. They're kind of just like the third fight of a random pay-per-view and just kind of keep busy fights for some of the best and most popular fighters in the UFC.
RJ Clifford on ESPN Las Vegas. They're moving to Paramount. You know a lot more behind the scenes at UFC than I do. How much control does UFC have of Paramount promos? Because I could swear I saw a Paramount promo for 2026, and the first face I saw, John Jones. We're relying on John Jones. First face I saw, John Jones.
At least it wasn't Conor McGregor, right?
Yeah. Well, that would have been really telling. But this is quite telling, because I'm joking about, like, how much control does UFC have? They have control.
They have control, and even more so than in the ESPN days. So this is kind of like inside baseball-ish, but the UFC always controls production, right? You watch an NFL game, it's NBC, ABC, whatever. Baseball game, it's Fox, whatever, right? UFC staff, producers, everyone do the fights. It's not a ESPN, it wasn't a Spike, and the same thing with Paramount. There were a couple things that ESPN controlled. They controlled like the desk segments of pay-per-views. That's all now gone. Now it's all UFC. And there's even other like very minute elements that literally three people hearing my voice kind of care about, but production control's only gone more on the UFC side. And I think that's correct, right? Like Paramount, CBS, like how much boxing, MMA, combat sports experience do they have? I think they realize, like, look, we don't have an ego here. We're not going to be like, oh, we can do this as well as you. We'll just figure it out in the next 4 months. And they're like, nope, UFC, we're paying you a – that's probably why – I'm sure that's part of the reason why the $7.7 billion is going to the UFC. That's a lot of production costs that the UFC is now picking up. I think that was part of it too. Like, not just why, not just that they're getting this, you know, these TV products that people want to buy, but it's like, you're going to pay for all this production.
Last one on UFC, you're going to a fight night card. You got a little bit of travel. Tell people where you're going. And it's a little bit more westernized because some of your trips to the Middle East have been pretty hardcore in terms of the rules, and you're not really a rules guy.
Well, you also know me exclusively as Vegas RJ, or like New York City at 2 a.m. RJ, which I guess it's fair. That's RJ on a Tuesday anywhere as well. So I guess I'm lying a little bit. But the UFC heads to Doha. I still can't get Qatar.
I like Qatar.
I like Qatar, but people keep giving me crap for not saying Qatar. It's kind of like everyone says it wrong. So if you say it right, you sound like a jerk. It's like ordering like a quesadilla at a Mexican restaurant. Like, just say quesadilla, dude. You're blonde hair, blue eyed, 42-year-old. Just say quesadilla. Stop sounding like a schmuck. So I still haven't decided what to call it. But yeah, it's the UFC's going to Qatar. Really fun card. I mentioned Armin Sarukian, Dan Hooker. Armin Sarukian should be the number one contender if he wins. Bilal Muhammad, Ian Machado Gary, who we just mentioned. Bilal Muhammad, former champion. Ian Machado Gary could very well be the number one contender as well with a win. And obviously a lot of fighters from that neck of the woods out there. And this is the third time this year, Cofield, I had to go on a map, like literally look at a globe to see where I was headed.
By the way, Bilal and JDM at 170 can be really good gatekeepers too. I mean, that's how deep this division is. It's pretty crazy. Bilal was on top of the mountain and all of a sudden he could be looking at being like seventh or eighth in the freaking division. Well, if there were eight teams in the AFC West, the division, Raiders might be the eighth. That last night was unbelievable. I was at Ellis Island doing a Monday night football party. It was probably 70-80% Cowboys fans. And I just felt so bad for the Raiders fans. That was, I don't care what the score was in the end. It was just so embarrassing. And the first thing to get to is, I can't believe they have a $6 million offensive coordinator. And everyone's like, you got to dump them. I mean, how is this not working to this level? It's 15 points per game.
Cofield. Was that even top five most embarrassing losses this season for the Raiders? It might not even be top five when you stop and look at how many bad losses they've had this season. The Kansas City, who put in their backups like towards the end of the third quarter, Geno had 67 yards passing. Washington had Marcus Mariota lighting up the Raiders for over 40 points. Indy slapped 40 on the Raiders as well. The Broncos just last week doing everything they possibly could to hand a win to the Raiders, but the Raiders special teams and offense still blows it. Like, that's just like how dead inside I think Raiders fans are now, where it's like, yeah, getting completely embarrassed on Monday Night Football against America's team. And it's kind of just like, yeah, if what's dead can never die. What was that line from Game of Thrones? Like, that's what it feels like at this point. And this is the weird thing though. I thought that was one of Chip Kelly's better games. I really do. Like, they got the play action going because it was like it was a game where I think Chip Kelly finally understood how predictable he was on first down, just running into a mound of nothing. The Raiders' offensive line is terrible and only getting worse. Jackson Powers, the two best O-linemen, Colt Miller, Jackson Powers Johnson, out. They moved around their guards and centers. They refused to play any young rookies. It's only getting worse. So Chip Kelly's like, I don't trust this line. Let's play action, get Geno out, moving around. Some screens. They got Ashton Jeanty involved in the passing game. Geno, 35 now, but he showed his best scrambling and running he has of the season so far. And again, 16 points against one of the worst defenses in football. Not a good performance, but it was better than the last few weeks. Wow. It was better than the last few weeks. I guess, sad but true.
I guess I got sucked into the crowd's disappointment, the Raiders fans. And I love glass overflowing. RJ, I mean, I just think of a couple of moments, and they really were back-to-back. The safety. That was just unreal. I mean, poor Ashton Jeanty gets the ball, jumps to plant, and then Troy Aikman's like, basically, you can't do that. Like, I guess he's got to just run full speed, jam himself into the line. But I think he jumped because he was like, my God, there's three guys in front of me already.
Well, if you're ready for glass overflowing RG to be done, that wasn't even top three most embarrassing plays of the night for me. Like, how about that perfect onside kind of drop kick punt? Like, that was a great call by Pete Carroll. That was a perfectly executed kind of like onside kick. And then the Raiders players surrounding the ball were just like shocked and surprised that a ball was in their general vicinity. I swear to God, one of the players, I wish I remember his number, literally like jumped away like he was scared of it. He was like, oh God, a ball in my area? What am I going to do? Like, there was that one. Pickens running all over the DBs was super embarrassing. And how about this one? Dallas is getting ready to take a knee on like the 8. They're willing to say like, okay, game's over. We're giving you mercy. And the Raiders have too many men on the field and there's a penalty. The Raiders can't even take mercy correctly without screwing it up.
Yeah, you beat me to the punch on the punt. I could not believe. First of all, I thought that Cole kicked it backwards. And then as it comes down, I'm like, holy crap, that was perfect.
Perfect.
Why doesn't everyone run? Because it was like 13 yards. Why, in that case, everyone run to the 40, turn, and look. Instead, they're all like, I mean, it's Carter Runyon was the guy who was shocked and jumped out of the way. Like, they actually did something brilliantly and still blanked it up.
AJ Cole, like, once again, like, you got Shane Leckler, who's on the short list of getting into Hall of Fame, longtime Raiders punter of the 2000s, of terrible years. The Raiders are bound and determined to make AJ Cole a Pro Bowl punter. Mm-hmm. With just a crappy offense, great onside kicks, and just and that's a live ball. You don't have to wait for the ball to hit the ground. It doesn't have to touch an opposing player. Just catch it. And the game was basically already out of hand, but a little some positivity, some little momentum, right? Nope, can't do it.
Well, I wonder how Raiders fans are going to get into a lather this week, because Shedeur Sanders is terrible. He is awful. He is not ready at all. This has to be a win. Crazy enough, these teams with whatever they have, 5 wins combined, this is going to be one of the national focus games all week long on Talking Head Radio and TV. Mm-hmm. Raiders have got to get a win against a guy who is absolutely not ready to start in the NFL.
Well, that Cleveland defense is so good that do they? Do the Raiders have to win? We've seen the Raiders against really good defenses, right? Top, like the... Okay, the Broncos might have the best defense in football. We saw what they did to the Raiders. The Chiefs blanked the Raiders. Top 10 defense, they're good. Like, they're not crazy knock your socks off, but they're top 10 defense. They're really good. And the Browns are right up there with those defenses. So, like, as bad as Shedeur Sanders is, and he got and who knows how he's going to do with, like, a full week of practice and first-team reps, and if he gets any better, who knows, right? But – we saw, what, 2 seasons ago on Thursday Night Football, Baker Mayfield came in on 43 hours notice and beat the Raiders. And this team is worse than that one. This Pete Carroll team is worse than Antonio Pierce, Josh McDaniels. This team is worse.
Worst offensive team points per game since Jamarcus Russell's team.
Finding new
lows. You're setting new standards. It's pretty crazy. Autumn Windbacks podcast, MMA Maven. You can find him up on Twitter at RJ Clifford MMA. Enjoy your trip to Qatar. Qatar should be a good fight card, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Steve.
RJ Clifford on ESPN Las Vegas. Spots brought to you by Boomer Sportsbook. 2 locations in Southern Nevada, Ellis Island Casino and Casino Valle Verde. Boomer's local Nevada book, built on player-first mindset, fair pricing, and unmatched promotions like -105 the rest of the way on all pro football spreads in the regular season. First deposit match, up to $250 in bonus bets. Same game parlay bonuses all the time. And you want to be part of the rewards club with Boomers. Get in there, sign up. Takes less than 5 minutes. Frankly, you can do most of it at home on your phone. You make the deposit. You're good to go. It's Boomer Sportsbook. Check it out at Ellis Island Casino or Casino Valley Verde.